Good evening. It's Saturday, November 21st, 2020. Coming up, with a president who refuses to concede and a number of other challenges, some question what the Biden administration will be able to accomplish.
You can cancel student debt. You can lower prescription drug prices. You can break up banks.
For the first time ever, the absentee ballot in Alabama had a box for incarcerated people to check.
The importance of having that on the ballot is now people see that people that are incarcerated, directly impacted people, are people.
Activists call for accountability in social media.
The thing about Facebook that is so unfriendly to democracy is that Mark Zuckerberg is really not responsible to anyone.
Friends and family of incarcerated Tyjon Shepherd call for him to get access to proper medical care.
I'm trying to keep him alive. I'm trying to, you know, remind him you have a reason to still be here.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News.
Some people are wondering what Joe Biden can really do once he becomes president if Congress is still controlled by Republicans. To find out, we spoke with David Day, an executive editor of the American Prospect.
Obviously, this is a unique situation where we have a president coming in without full control of Congress among his party. That's pretty unusual for the last 30 years or so. So the question is, how do you make progress? How do you fulfill campaign promises if Mitch McConnell has a veto over everything you do? And, you know, even in a best case scenario where Democrats win the two Georgia Senate runoffs, it's still going to be a 50-50 Senate. It's very unlikely that you'll get like a wide range of legislative action done due to that structure of what the Senate's going to look like. So actually, last fall, we published this series called The Day One Agenda, which was about everything a president can do without the benefit of new legislation. And as we studied this, you know, we found it was a really robust agenda. You can do a lot of stuff. You can cancel student debt. You can lower prescription drug prices. You can break up banks. You can, you know, engage in breakups of large corporations.
And this is by issuing executive orders, or is there, are there other ways?
Actually, primarily how you can do this is through the implementation of existing laws. So, you know, a president's job function really is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And over the last couple centuries or so, Congress has passed a number of laws, some of which are in various stages of implementation, some of which have not been used, in my opinion, to their fullest potential. And so all of the things we talk about in the Day One Agenda are authorities given exclusively to the president through an act of Congress. So Congress has written this law, and it's just up to a President Biden or President whoever to execute the law. And there simply are just a lot of opportunities if you start thinking in this direction with this orientation to really make progress for the American people.
That's David Dayen of the American Prospect.
As Trump still refuses to concede the election results and tries to discount absentee ballots in states that have traditionally been red, people like Pastor Kenneth Glasgow from the Ordinary People Society are celebrating their successes and making voting more accessible to incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. Glasgow is the half-brother of the Reverend Al Sharpton. After being incarcerated himself for 14 years, Glasgow says he made it his life's work to make voting accessible to everyone.
We started TOPS in 1994 while I was still incarcerated in Florida. 7 years later, I got out in 2001, and we continued to work. However, when I got out, I found out I couldn't vote. And I got very, very angry, and I said, okay, if I can't vote, I'm going to make sure every guy, dog, body I know can vote. And I start going to register people to vote who have felonies and all that, but I also start going inside the jails.
Glasgow says that although his state of Alabama went to Trump this election, he's celebrating a different victory as it relates to voting and ballot accessibility.
What we have been able to accomplish in Alabama is insurmountable, being that right now on the absentee ballot, Ms. Sharon, we have on the Alabama absentee ballot, I am currently incarcerated in jail /prison and have not committed a crime of moral turpitude. That's the first one in the history of any state in the United States that is on the actual ballot.
So the importance of having that check mark on the absentee ballot is because that way they're documenting that this portion of people gets access to voting. Is that right?
Well, the main thing about it is there's only two states that you can actually vote out of prison and jail, and that is Maine and Vermont. That's the way it used to be before my lawsuit in Florida 2007, then 2008, Alabama, and now Mississippi. And they never lost their voting rights. But of course, let's look at the general population in Maine and Vermont. 7% Black and Hispanics, they're people of color in Maine, and 9% in Vermont. So of course, they never lost their voting rights. When you get it on a ballot, the absentee ballot, it marks the fact that they cannot take away the access of the ballot to people that are currently incarcerated.
Glasgow says he hopes that in the future, the 13th Amendment will be amended.
Just heard Kamala say, you know, Black Lives Matter has brought this conversation to the fruition. All of us, the formerly incarcerated people, our work in all 20 years. I mean, we have all done work to get it to that point. But classism is what totally separates us. And the importance of having that on the ballot is now people see that people that are incarcerated, directly impacted people, are people.
That's Kenneth Glasgow from the Ordinary People Society.
One of the most indelible images of the Trump administration is the pictures of immigrant children in cages. Some people even voted for the Democratic candidate because they believe things will be different under a Joe Biden presidency. But not everyone believes that. Adrienne Pine is an associate professor of anthropology at American University. She says one reason she doesn't have much faith in Biden on the immigration issue is because of his past behavior. He was, after all, vice president under the man immigration rights activists referred to as the deporter-in-chief. And the so-called Biden plan he came up with for Central America involved millions of dollars for repressive regimes and for mega projects that caused the displacement of many people. But there is another reason as well.
Equally concerning are the appointments to his transition team, both his DHS transition team, Department of Homeland Security transition team that's focused on immigration policy, but also his transition team more broadly, which really heavily features people who are, you know, coming from industries that are going to profit significantly from war and investments in the kinds of border security that have led people to call Trump's own policies genocidal and really stem themselves from the Obama-Biden administration policies.
But what about the asylum issue? I mean, it's an internationally recognized right to seek asylum. Do you think on that issue that this administration will be a little better?
You know, I think that there will be some superficial differences, but really emphasis on the superficial. You know, I think that he's going to throw some crumbs to DACA recipients and things like that. But all indications are that Biden plans to continue the same sort of investment in border security, and I'm including the infrastructure of detaining migrants in that. Even, you know, a number of the people who are on his DHS transition team promote building more migrant detention centers to detain more asylum seekers. And, you know, I mean, detention is a very sort of kind word for what in effect have become death camps, in particular in the era of COVID. And again, you know, Obama and Biden initiated the policy of caging children, of child separation, and that was largely of people who were seeking asylum from Central American countries. And I think another issue is that there would need to be really a forward-thinking radical change in terms of the overarching asylum structure, given the fact that there has been such a systematic replacement of asylum judges at the federal court level over the past 40 years, in large part through Koch brothers' intervention and things like that.
That's American University professor Adrienne Pine.
It's been 2 weeks since the national elections, and this week the Senate Judiciary Committee took big tech and social media barons to task for their company's roles in the recent elections. Democrats and Republicans grilled Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg about how they did not do enough to curb misinformation on their social platforms. Meanwhile, in San Francisco today, the Global Exchange, a coalition of activist groups, protested in front of Mark Zuckerberg's home and called on the Facebook founder to stop enabling lies and putting democratic rights at risk. KPFA's Lola Akamu reports.
Since the beginning of his presidential term, President Trump has used his social media accounts as his unofficial mouthpiece to connect with his followers and also to the American people. The role of big tech and social media in the democratic process has been a topic of concern for many Americans since the 2016 election. Many blame social media companies for not doing enough to stop the flow of disinformation and for changing the landscape of social and political discourse. Policymakers have been at a loss as to how to handle big tech companies, and there have been calls to deregulate and break up their power and influence. Ted Lewis is a co-director with Global Exchange. He says Facebook undermines mainstream media and that the company is unfriendly to democracy.
Facebook is part of a much bigger problem. During the election, one of the interesting things about the protest against Facebook is that a lot of it has come from and or been echoed inside of Facebook's corporate structure itself. So there have been a lot of people speaking out, both former Facebook people, some of whom have been on webcasts that we've organized, as well as staff. And that's put a lot of pressure on Mark Zuckerberg. But the thing about Facebook that is so unfriendly to democracy in so many ways is that Mark Zuckerberg is really not responsible to anyone, not his own board of directors, not his employees, not, you know, you and me, Jane and Joe Public, not to anybody, because he owns enough of the company that basically what he says goes.
Lewis says Facebook does not do enough to stop disinformation and sells information for profit.
They don't do any of the work. You know, they don't do any real investigation. You can't count on them to sort out whether you should believe something or not. They just put it up on their pages and profit massively. And at the same time, while they talk about the values of bringing people together, they sound like great people, you know, wanting the world to be closer. But instead, they've wound up being the agents of dividing our country. I mean, who hasn't gotten triggered on Facebook? And the thing is that when you get triggered on Facebook, for them, that's profitable, because then you go and you start engaging and you say this and you do that and you get into it. So they have tried to amp up the fights. And that's a known fact. And that plays into the hands of people who are undermining democracy.
Again, that was Ted Lewis with Global Exchange. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
In the midst of all the protests against the police killings of Black people, many police departments across the country have come in for their fair share of criticism on the issue of excessive use of force. The Los Angeles Police Department is one of them. Like many other departments, the LAPD has long been seen by anti-police abuse activists as a racist department. Rev. Lennox Yearwood is the president of the Hip Hop Caucus. He talked about the LAPD and the problem of police abuse.
The Hip Hop Caucus, you know, our belief is that the Los Angeles Police Department has been very problematic, particularly as in its response to Black and Brown and Indigenous people. And a lot of how they responded to people of color has looked, appeared, and felt racist. And I think there's been many things that have shown that they have a different way of policing people of color. And I think that is at the core what we want changed. We don't want to be policed differently than other communities. We don't even want to be policed differently than those who look different than us in our communities. As a matter of fact, sometimes in communities that are vulnerable and that are dealing with a lot of different issues, you need more resources for those communities because the stress levels are high. The last thing you need is for folks who do not respect your community and, God forbid, are racist against you personally, trying to police you. Just the idea of somebody policing you who doesn't like you can lead to catastrophic, horrific consequences.
If you go back a few decades with the founding of the Black Panther Party, they used to refer to police departments as occupying armies. Do you think that's still true?
You know, I would say this. I definitely don't disagree with that sentiment. What I would say, though, is that I think that since that time, and this is now even before my time, I would say that there have been some gains. I think it would be unfair to say that there have been outreach as far as even trying to hire. There's been many cases where we know, particularly in LA, where they've had to, you know, obviously have the police department looked upon from, you know, the aspect of having the federal government and other aspects looking upon their practices. So I would say that while there's still clearly not enough improvement, and while we don't feel the police departments, how they're structured now, need to be in place, and there needs to be a community control over those entities. I don't want to create something that becomes a hot button where people use certain language to then create more of a wedge, because at the end of the day, the people who we work with at Hip Hop Caucus are the ones suffering because of unjust police and unjust police practices.
That's Rev Lennox Yearwood of the Hip Hop Caucus.
You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Family, friends, and supporters of 18-year-old Tyjon Shepherd are gathering outside of the Martinez Detention Center on Sunday afternoon, demanding that he gets access to proper medical care. Livette Alexander is Shepherd's mother. She says that in addition to struggling with mental health issues, her son's overall health has deteriorated since he was detained.
About a week after his incarceration, Tyjon had called me and he had developed a really bad stutter. He's never had a stutter problem a day in his life. At first, it wasn't anything that was like really alarming. He just kind of thought that he could work it out on his own. But as I would talk to him, you know, every single day, the stutter was getting worse. And then he started to develop like weakness in the right side of his body. And now he has memory loss now. He cannot remember his birthday without looking at a piece of paper. He does not know what my birthday is. He does not know what his three siblings' birthdays are. He is forgetting who some of his closest friends are, people that he was with every single day, talked to every single day. I have to basically give a description of what they look like, you know, how he knows them, things that they used to do. And sometimes stuff will come back to his memory, and sometimes he just completely forgets who somebody is.
Alexander says her son's future depends on proper and sustained access to healthcare and psychological care.
This is a person. This is somebody's son. This is somebody's brother. This is somebody's uncle. He's very well known in the community and well liked. And well loved, you know, and he's only 18 years old. Just come support, you know, we need support. We need this boy, you know, in us, like she said, in a certified facility. Because at the end of the day right now, my son, he doesn't want to be alive. He just told me that last night. I'm trying to keep him alive. I'm trying to, you know, remind him you have a reason to still be here.
Courtney Morris is with No Justice Under Capitalism. She says that healthcare is a human right for everyone, including the incarcerated.
Out of all industrialized developed countries, the United States least prioritizes healthcare amongst its citizenry, but it is a right. It is a human right, and incarcerated people are human beings, and so they should have just as much access.
Morris says Contra Costa County has a history of providing inadequate healthcare access to the people it incarcerates.
While Tyjon Shepherd's denial of healthcare access is the story of one individual, it really represents a systemic issue in Contra Costa County. In fact, they were sued by the prison law office for medical negligence and lost the suit in October, and have agreed to pay $250 million over the course of the next 5 years into jail health care.
Sunday's action will be at 2 p.m. outside of the Martinez Detention Center. For more information, visit social media pages for No Justice Under Capitalism.
The European refugee crisis continues to be a big concern for governments on the continent. The backlash against the mass migration that took place in 2015 has not gone away, and some observers fear it could get worse. Anthony Lowenthal is an independent journalist, author, and filmmaker based in Sydney, Australia, who's been following the issue.
The danger, I think, of the anti-immigration sentiment is that nothing has changed, really, in the countries that are causing the dislocation in the first place. Yes, the war in Syria is not as ferocious as it was, to be sure, but much of the country is in ruin, the economy is destroyed, America under Trump was put on crushing sanctions. So although less people are leaving the country, virtually not many people are going back. So people are still looking for a home. And a lot of the Middle East is deeply unstable, as is much of Africa. Although most refugees do stay in their own country or in their region, the situation hasn't radically changed. And yet Europe increasingly is becoming what I would call Fortress Europe, which is much more hardline, much more use of drones and not armed, but drones, monitoring drones, to keep people out. And because they think that this is what populations want. And in some countries, I suspect that they're right.
Have we seen anything like this movement of people before? I mean, on the one hand, it seems like there's constant migration and movement of populations. Is this something out of the ordinary?
So the current migration, according to the UN, is the highest since World War II. There's roughly, at the moment, we don't know exactly, but roughly 70 million plus people who are on the move. They're not solely in the Middle East, but the Middle East, obviously, in the last 2 decades since 9/11, the various US-led wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya collapsing, many other countries in a very bad shape, Afghanistan, have led to huge amounts of migration. And so, yes, to the extent that it's the greatest number since World War II, and of course the fear is that, as I said, while the levels of dislocation in all these countries is not reduced, the next likely wave of refugees in the coming decades will be climate refugees, which is, I would argue, going to dwarf the number of refugees who are currently trying to get into Western countries, Europe, America, Australia, etc. I mean, that to me is the next major, not just a wave, but I don't mean that in a scary way. I'm just simply saying that they're going to be vast parts of the world that become uninhabitable. And that's moving that direction now.
That's independent journalist and author Anthony Lowenthal.
Ugandan police have shot at least 37 people dead during protests that erupted after the arrest of Ugandan pop singer, parliamentarian, and presidential candidate Bobi Wine. KPFA's Anne Garrison has the story.
Ugandan pop star and parliamentarian Bobi Wine's full name is Robert Kyagulanyi. The 38-year-old is also known as the ghetto president. In 2017, he won a parliamentary seat by a wide margin after a door-to-door campaign. In July 2018, Ugandan military police arrested him while he was campaigning for another parliamentary candidate and beat him so badly that he left jail leaning on a cane with a fellow party member helping him walk. Nevertheless, on November 3rd, Wine declared himself a candidate for president, announcing that he would run against General Yoweri Museveni, who has held a grip on power in Uganda for the past 34 years. Ugandans will go to the polls on January 14, 2021. On Wednesday, Uganda's military police arrested Wine again and did not release him until Friday. During that time, protests erupted across the country and police shot protesters to kill. On November 20, the New York Times reported that at least 28 protesters had been shot dead, while Al Jazeera reported 37 and still counting. The Times reported 600 arrested. I asked Ugandan-American journalist, Black Star News editor, and City College of New York professor Milton Alamadi to explain why the U.S. foreign policy establishment has enabled President Yoweri Museveni for so long.
The answer is simple. He is a puppet, a stooge that the United States finds reliable to further U.S. interest, not only in Uganda, but in the entire region. This is the classic neocolonial regime that Kwame Nkrumah warned against in 1965, when he wrote Neocolonialism, the Last Stage of Imperialism. So you have an African puppet dictator that enables the environment for U.S. and European multinational corporations to exploit Uganda's resources. And as you know, Uganda had invaded Congo multiple times and occupied eastern Congo, and Western corporations were exploiting resources of the Congo without having to pay a dime in taxes to the central government in the Congo. And how was that accomplished? Through Uganda. Even as we speak today, Uganda is exporting gold and diamonds from the Congo. Uganda does not produce significant quantities of gold. There was a Wall Street Journal article recently that documented this continuing crimes enabled by this reliable U.S. puppet in Uganda. And Museveni also acts as the policeman in the region for U.S. and Western interests. So in addition to policing the Congo, he also has at least 10,000 Ugandan soldiers based in Somalia, which the United States fears might become a haven for Al-Qaeda and other groups. That is the alleged rationale. So instead of basing U.S. troops in Somalia, you have Ugandan soldiers paid for by the West. And in fact, we have evidence that Uganda is exacerbating the conflict in Somalia by selling weapons to Al-Shabaab, which the United States says is an affiliate or an alliance with Al-Qaeda. And why does Uganda do this? To prolong the agony in Somalia, necessitating the presence of Ugandan troops there, and thereby having access to U.S. weapons and U.S. financial support. He is the classic neocolonial dictator in Africa. That is why the United States has enabled him all these many decades.
That was Ugandan-American journalist, Black Star News editor, and City College of New York professor Milton Alamadi. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
The Arab Studies Coalition expressed its outrage this week over the State Department of Education's decision to relegate Arab Studies to the appendix of its California Model Ethnic Studies curriculum. KPFA's Diana Kapkaban reports.
Earlier this week, a contentious meeting of California's Instructional Quality Commission revealed sharp differences over the proposed content of the Ethnic Studies model curriculum. Keith Feldman is an associate professor of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley and the secretary of the Arab American Studies Association. He describes the Arab American Studies model curriculum as being grounded in decades of scholarship, well-organized and richly developed.
The proposal includes four fully developed lesson plans laid out carefully over 50 pages. The lesson plans cover the history of Arab American immigration, a portrait of Arab and Muslim Americans and the challenges they've faced, an investigation of Islamophobia, and a wonderfully creative unit on hip-hop as resistance, introducing students to the ways anti-Arab stereotypes are both embedded and challenged in U.S. popular culture.
Feldman says that Palestine's history is an important part of student learning about social movements.
It is a part, one small, crucial, constituent part of a much larger Arab American studies curriculum, alongside work about Syrians, Lebanese, Egyptians, Yemenis, Iraqis, and situated in relation to histories of U.S. warfare and empire in the Middle East, in Central Asia, and an important juxtaposition to the framing of Afghanistan and Iran. The call to develop nonviolent practices of boycott, divestment, and sanctions is introduced as one of 12 potential social movements for students to study, alongside other movements like the Occupy movement, the Defend Science or Climate movement, the Me Too movement.
Christine Hong is a professor and director of critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz. She talked about the racial aspect of U.S. foreign policy and how it relates to the need for Arab studies.
And I think that what we have to think about is really how the racism of U.S. foreign policy, how U.S. intervention racializes. And it racializes not only in terms of the target abroad or over there, but it racializes in terms of racial profiling, gatekeeping here in the construction of internal enemies. And so we have to think about the target and racial profiling as drawing from the same logic. You can't imagine that post 9/11, you would not be thinking so centrally about Arab American studies in conversation with racial profiling.
In Berkeley for Pacifica KPFA, this is Diana Kapkaban.
And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, cloudy tonight with lows in the 40s. Cloudy again tomorrow with highs in the low 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, cloudy tonight, lows in the 40s. Sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid 60s. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to Lola Akamu, Diana Kapkaban, and Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.